The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. Today, my guest is a nature writer, novelist and columnist for The Times. Her first novel, Clay, was published in 2013, followed by At Hawthorne Time and All Among the Barley. Her non-fiction books include Rain, Four Walks in English Weather. She has contributed episodes to Radio 4's Tweet of the Day and made appearances on BBC Two's Springwatch. She's developing an app as well to connect people to nature. Please welcome my guest, Melissa Harrison. Hello, Melissa.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I'm actually struggling with the rain, and I think we're going to talk about rain a little bit.
Oh, God.
I don't take to meteorological conditions universally well. Some I like, and some I don't, and rain and wind I don't. But in your writing, rain seems to act as a kind of inspiration for you. So I'm going to use that as my jumping off point, because we always ask our guests on the Inspired Minds podcast, what is inspiration for you? What does it mean?
Well, firstly, I just want to say I have put myself in a difficult position with rain, and I've become somewhat of an apologist for it, having written a book about it. And now it won't stop, and there's too much, and I'm not allowed to complain about it. So just to put that out there, it's not always a good thing. But to return to your question, it's tricky, isn't it? I think inspiration is where purpose meets ability. It's where your sense of what you're for overlaps with what you can contribute to the world. And I think in that space, there's a sense of moving forward and contributing and perhaps even nudging the dial in a direction that matters to you. And for me, that's very much to do with helping people to connect to nature.
You sound like you have a strong sense of purpose. That isn't the case for everybody. Where do you think you get that from? And what is that sense of purpose for you?
I haven't always. I think it happened around when I was coming up to 30. I grew up in the late 70s and early 80s. And I think looking back, I was a member of the last generation that were allowed to play outside unsupervised. And that's a world that's pretty much been lost now. So being connected to nature was quite natural for me and for most of my cohort, you know, to different degrees. So it was normal that children, you know, certainly where I was growing up in Surrey, that we would know, you know, basic names of trees and plants and flowers, you know, maybe not extensively as people would have in the 50s, but it was part of children's reality in a way that it isn't really now. But on top of that, I think I was probably more enthusiastic than a lot of the children around me, partly because I was really quite lonely. I'm the youngest in a big family. There's six of us, and there's quite a large gap between me and the others. The others were all planned, and I was an accident that came along a little bit too late. And so they played together, and they had best friends in the family, and I was, you know, tagging along. And I was also not a child that fitted in well at school, you know, in the way that some children don't. And the natural world became a solace for me. I used to climb trees a lot, and I had particular trees that I connected to and felt were my friends and felt were, you know, pleased to see me and that liked me more than the other children. So I had this quite rich imaginative world that was connected with nature. And then, like most children, I went to secondary school and it went into the background and I kind of lost interest. And all the way through my 20s, I wasn't interested. I was living in London and I was, you know, starting my life and doing, you know, the first of a series of badly paid and not very satisfying jobs, as people do, going out and making friends. But during that time, I was losing something, although I couldn't have told you what it was. I was losing that sense of connection and knowledge about the seasons and just the sense of sort of tracking where we were in time. And after a very bad breakup, I ended up going to Devon, which is where we spent a lot of time as children. And there I had a kind of epiphany. I realized how much I needed to be outside and I needed to see living, growing things. And I moved back to London. Well, I came back to London. It was just a brief holiday. And I couldn't really change my life immediately, but not long after that, we broke up. I moved south of the river and eventually ended up in a flat with a little garden. And that was a real turning point because I could start growing things. And it also meant I could get a dog. And getting a dog means that you walk the dog and you're going out and discovering little parks and commons and walking the streets and seeing the blossom and seeing how things change over the course of a year. My whole experience of London was transformed, completely transformed. And so was my mental health and my emotional state. My reality changed because I was noticing different things. I realise now, you know, it's very like social media. Who you follow on whichever platform determines the quality of your experience on that platform. And if you interact with political posts, you'll see more political content. And you know, the algorithm kind of gives us what we're more of what we're interested in. And it's the same with attention to anything. A lot of people will know what it's like to be buying a house and suddenly you notice all the for sale boards everywhere that you wouldn't normally notice the rest of the time. It's the same with nature. The more you tune in, the more your attention sharpens, the more your knowledge broadens, and your reality begins to change. You know, the science around nature connectedness, which is incredibly exciting at the moment, is showing that this is really real and really measurable. We evolved in natural environments. We didn't evolve in the indoors with air conditioning and electric light and, you know, filtered air and all of the conveniences that we have. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have those conveniences. They're transformative and wonderful. But our bodies and our minds are slightly thrown off by these changes that we've made that are really, you know, in the blink of an eye in evolutionary terms. This is only the last couple of hundred years. And what the science is starting to show us is that losing our connection with the natural world in which we evolved is causing us very small but measurable harms. And so by increasing it, by getting outside more, by changing our reality in the way that I've just described, we can return ourselves to a happier and more balanced state and a healthier state as well. I mean, some of the science, you know, people recover from surgery more quickly if they have a view of trees outside a hospital window rather than a brick wall. I mean, that's extraordinary.
I hear the phrase, is it tree bathing?
Forest bathing.
Forest bathing, that's right.
Yeah, it's a Japanese concept.
Well, I live in Tooting, which is, I think, where you were for a while, Tooting back.
I used to walk on the common, yeah.
Exactly. I read you writing about it with a certain degree of pride. And I have Wandsworth Common near me in one direction and Tooting Beck Common the other way. And it was during COVID, I think, that we suddenly saw on the commons, partly because everyone had a constitutional, didn't they? They were allowed out for an hour. That meant that we would all go out dutifully, us law-abiding citizens, would go and take our one-hour constitutional. And suddenly, the commons that I used to, you know, probably visit once or twice a week for a little walk, I was on every day. Mm. And so was everybody else, as if everybody kind of knew that they needed it.
Yes.
So it's something deep inside us, isn't it? Because suddenly, actually, the common was getting rather trampled and areas were becoming muddy, which had never previously been walked on. And it was full of people. So is that something that we just know but haven't articulated?
I think that one of the extraordinary things about COVID was this collective reaching out for nature. I think it was also the feeling of something ancient that continued and that was trustworthy and that was this ancient rhythm that we could rely on when everything else was so frightening. So it was that as well. And for nature writers like me who have been banging this drum for quite a long time in fiction, in nonfiction, in columns, in whatever medium we could, it was hugely exciting to see people going, oh God, nature's really good and I need it and I want to go and connect with it. And we all really hoped that those effects of, you know, people suddenly noticing birdsong and things like that would continue. Some of the studies are showing that it hasn't. People have just gone back to their everyday lives, which is a great shame. But I think, you know, some of the habits that people took up, walking and gardening, feeding the birds, I hope are persisting. That was the reason that I made the podcast that I did in the first year of the pandemic, because there were a lot of people who had that urge to get outside, but actually didn't have anywhere to go. Didn't have a garden or weren't near a park or a common. My niece was close to Wimbledon Common, but she had complex health needs and she couldn't really go outside at all. She had a little bit of space outside near some bins and her landlady got annoyed with her and her boyfriend standing outside in this little shaft of sunlight. So there were a lot of people who weren't being able to access this thing that we needed so much. So that's why I made a podcast to try and get out once a week and show people what was happening in nature and the seasons. And so, yeah, that's that sense of purpose that you asked about. That's what I'm trying to do all the time, is having experienced this for myself, is just to find ways to say to people, this can change your life. It's really easy. It's really pleasurable. And it has benefits to nature as well. The more people that care and have that sense of custodianship, that's really what we need. We're going into an extinction crisis. We're in it. You know, we are losing birds, insects, mammals, all sorts of things that we grew up with and took for granted, like hedgehogs, at an alarming rate. So for me, it's a double-edged benefit. It's benefit to us and to the natural world, and that's what I'm trying to do.
You've talked there about the extinction of animals, and you've written about this, and 60% of animal species are under threat, breeding pairs of birds being decimated, more than decimated. You know, as you were reading it, I was thinking about the humble earwig. When I was a child in my back garden in Clapham, earwigs were a real pain, and there were lots of them.
Mm.
I can't remember seeing an earwig for about 30 years. We hear about this impending extinction and extinction event, but it's all a bit mammoth, and I don't think people understand why it's happening. But why, for example, has the earwig disappeared from my garden?
That might be because you're just not looking for it in the same way that you were once. So we have to be careful of anecdota. But we are, you know, there is no doubt that we are experiencing an insect apocalypse. Some species doing better, but most species are declining in at various rates. And that's to do with all sorts of things, from light pollution is one of the biggest. You know, if you have a security light that's unshaded, if you have fairy lights in your garden, please look into shading them, turning them off, getting rid of them. We really need to reduce light pollution to help insect populations. Farming practices, so the use of things like neonicotinoids, the pet flea drops that we put on the back of our dogs' necks and then we let them play in water. It's absolutely devastating to insect populations in water. And the terrifying thing with insects is, of course, that they're at the bottom of the trophic pyramid. So they're one of the foundational things that other things rely on. You know, we're seeing the knock-on effects in birds that rely on them, like swifts and swallows. Their numbers are plummeting. These are, you know, huge populations of birds that used to move around the globe, constantly chasing insect booms. And now the insect booms are becoming incredibly unreliable. And climate change has an effect on it as well. So we're seeing that the timing of spring is becoming earlier and earlier by quite a measurable amount now. And that affects when there's new fresh growth on plants. And it's fresh growth on plants that triggers aphids, and it's aphids that a lot of birds need to feed their young. Also, caterpillars are a big food source for baby birds, and if the caterpillar explosion doesn't happen, the birds can't feed their chicks, so you end up with breeding collapses. You know, this is happening around us, but it's stuff that we can do. We can really support in our own gardens just through changing the way that we garden and doing a bit of learning about what lives around us and how we can help. There's things people can do.
Now, you've written about gardens, and specifically your mother's garden, and I suppose being slightly concerned when thinking about that garden now, that it was part of the problem, not the solution. You were so fond of it, and the flowers that were in it and the way it was arranged. But with your 21st century hat on, slightly reevaluating that garden, explain what I'm failing to explain.
Well, I think, you know, just like a lot of gardeners in the 70s and 80s, people used a lot of sprays and we grew a lot of non-native plants. And the thing is with plants that haven't evolved here is they've had less time to create relationships with other insects and other things that eat them. So our garden was, you know, sprayed and slug pelleted and full of dahlias and zinnias and things like that. And Dad mowed the lawn very close and dug out all the dandelions. And that was a garden that could have supported more life than it did. Although, you know, because it was 40 years ago, it did have more than we have now. So I remember things like there were lesser spotted woodpeckers in our garden. They are rare to the point of being uncountable in this country now, but we used to have them in the garden. I think some of what holds us back from changing the way that we garden and changing the way that we allow our parks to be managed, because managing for wildlife means them being a bit messier and a bit less nice to look at. I think there's this feeling of not wanting to be the bad guys, kind of not wanting to admit that we have caused the damage that we have, because it was, you know, we didn't know. My mum wasn't trying to, you know, kill wildlife. She was making a beautiful garden and she was proud of it and we loved it. It's hard to come to that acceptance that we need to do things a little bit differently, because no one wants to feel, you know, that enormous crushing sense of guilt. That's not productive for any of us. So just being able to say, okay, now we know a bit more, so we're going to make some changes. That's what we can do.
Is that sort of really at the root of the culture wars around land and land use? Because you've written also about, you know, the danger of arguments taking place which are not remotely helpful.
No.
And are not going to be constructive, and loosely described as culture wars. And essentially, is it that a culture war is actually fed by that, exactly what you're talking about, that sense of defensiveness? When somebody was doing something that we know now to be wrong, rather than lambasting them, there needs to be a bit more understanding. And of course, that defensiveness goes into a kind of feedback loop in which they then defend their previous position, much to the infuriation of the person on the other side, and then no one's listening.
Absolutely, yeah. We've got to stop the mudslinging. We've got to stop trying to make goodies and baddies, particularly with farmers. I think there's a lot of willingness to kind of, let's pin the blame on them because they own and manage most of the land. And we've heard that they're doing bad things with sprays and stuff like that. But farmers have always just had to respond to government policy. You know, when they grubbed up the hedges after the Second World War, it's because they were told that they needed to increase food production. You know, they are constantly caught between pillar and post. They're doing their best. They're working largely on very small margins. Most of the farmers I know actually take enormous pride in the wildlife that they have in their farms and often manage it, you know, out of their own pocket or in ways that they know to be the most effective. So a farmer near me who's doing amazing work for turtle doves, and he does it off his own bat. He's not part of any schemes. It's just something he wants to do. But I think there's something else with the culture wars around rewilding as well, which is to do with money and to do with class. And I think it's a shame that, you know, the government have been very slow to get these measures through to support changing the way that we use and manage land in a way that works for farmers. And so in that gap between there being a public realization that rewilding might be necessary and the government helping farmers to do it, the people that have been able to step into that gap are people with enough land or enough resources to make these changes quickly. So it has come to look like this is a rich person's toy. And that's where we start to do a bit of an us and them thing in this country. And we start to say, oh, it's a hobby for rich people. It's a shame.
How does that change? How can government intervene to make it better?
Oh, God. I.
Because you provide us with so much hope elsewhere. And yet every part of this seems to be very, very difficult.
Yeah, I don't have the answers to that. I know they've increased their payments for the environmental land management scheme, the top tier, and that's very good, but it's come very late. They need to be more clear. They need to also support improvements in food production, because we've seen all sorts of problems with production. The weather, the rain we were talking about earlier is just disastrous for farmers. And they need more help to produce food, and perhaps intensively in some areas, more intensively, so that marginal land can be released for rewilding. But it's an incredibly difficult balance. What we just need to do, and I know this sounds like a cliche, is a bit more listening and a little less throwing insults around on both sides.
I want to take you back to Dartmoor, because you've written something, and I've heard you speak about this in such a way that it made me think completely differently about what I was looking at. And you'd talk very fondly, because it was an area that you'd spent much of your childhood in, and I've been to Dartmoor and been amazed by it. But I've subsequently discovered, partly through you and others, that what I'm looking at is actually a potentially ecological disaster, a treeless wilderness ripped apart by sheep, which every time I've been on there, I've been, you know, walking around it, bathing in the majesty of the countryside and thinking, isn't this marvellous? But it isn't as marvellous as it looks, is it?
I think you're right. There are a lot of upland areas that shouldn't look as they do and should have more tree cover, more ecological diversity. I think Dartmoor is less bad than some because the areas of tree cover, it would have been quite small anyway. It's temperate rainforest, so it's stunted oaks and lichen and sort of in these areas of rocky glitter. Whereas there are other areas, particularly in Scotland, that would have had much more tree cover and that we can return to tree cover. But in terms of things like ground nesting birds, you know, Dartmoor should have curlews. It should have a lot more skylarks. It should have all sorts that aren't there. And a big part of that problem is not so much sheep. It's me and you and our dogs. And that for me, you know, as a dog lover, is a tough one because I thought, you know, my dog, she has a strong prey drive, but it's for small furry things. She doesn't care about birds. So I thought that was fine because she's not going to chase them. What I've learnt more recently is that just having a dog, even on a lead through an area where birds are nesting on the ground, increases nest failure and nest abandonment by quite a high degree because you're walking a predator close to where they are. They don't know that it's on a lead. So it's so hard, you know, this is a place that I love and enjoy and would love to send everyone else. It's a place where with amazing dark skies where hopefully we can continue to wild camp as well, let's hope. And so many people have been turned on to nature by this place and we need access, we need contact. And it's hard to realise that comes at a price for a lot of other animals, you know, us just being there.
Now, I want to move you now slightly towards, well, possibly this is going to take us in the direction of your fiction writing, but I've heard you talk about something called transient hyperfrontality, which you're able to induce in yourself, it seems, through exertion, exercise, going on a long walk. Would it be fair to say that transient hyperfrontality might be a source of inspiration?
So this is a term for a kind of brain activity that is linked to creativity. And what the theory is that it's a way of occupying enough of your mind that part of it is left to make connections between things that you wouldn't normally see. And so some people have this when they're ironing or jogging or doing the washing up. It's sort of doing things that take up just enough of your attention and often that involve your body in some way. And your brain just kind of goes on a little wander by itself. And I find that happens for me through walking. And often when I'm sitting at my desk puzzling over a plot problem, what I need to do is get up and go out for a walk and stop thinking about it. And that's when the answer will come. Or sometimes not the answer I was looking for, but an answer to something else, you know, much later in the book in a different chapter will pop in. And it feels like I sometimes think of it as being a little old lady who lives in my head, who's not very efficient and she's not very well in charge of the filing cabinets. And sometimes she opens a drawer and something else comes out, but she gets there and she's all I've got. So
I like the sound of this little old lady. She's at least driving you forward with a variety of thoughts, and your books, they're rich and layered. I mean, when you've got to get into, for example, 1933-34, you've got a pretty interesting latticework of characters and an entirely different time and an entirely different space. How do you go about, I suppose, weaving that tapestry together? You weren't around in 1933. Did you know that the space that you set it in? I believe you visited it, did you not, and sort of constructed a fictional.
Yes, I came out to Suffolk, where All Among the Barley set, several times during the course of writing it, because I needed to see it at different times of the year. I needed to see the crops at different heights. I needed to see what wildflowers were growing, because what grows in one part of the country doesn't necessarily grow in another. I wanted to get to know the types of buildings and how the light hit them at different times of the year, what the soil was like when it got wet, you know, was it claggy or was it dry, or, you know, how did that feel? And during the course of that research, I fell in love with Suffolk and ended up moving here. And that's where I live now, in a tiny little village, less than 200 people, in a little farm labourer's cottage. It would have been a one up, one down. It's been added onto.
Why is that level of specificity so important to your writing? I mean, other people wouldn't go to the extent of needing to know the consistency of the mud at different times of year.
No. I sometimes feel that novelists will have a way in, a starting point for what they create. And, you know, the general ones are plot, character, setting, theme, and form. And for me, it's setting that comes first. I want to know where I am. I want to know the geology, because that will dictate, you know, whether buildings are brick or flint or timber or whatever they are, and it will determine what grows. I want to know what the crops are. I want to build that world. That's where I start. And then comes character. Plot, unfortunately, comes last, which is a massive problem. Because, you know, I'm working on a book at the moment, and I have written 80,000 words, and I'm now trying to work out what it's about, and that's really hard. So it's not the way I would choose to do it. But that just seems to be the way it is for me, and has been for all of my novels.
Is that in part the sort of the young lonely girl you were describing earlier, who's the favourite of a certain tree, that you're almost gone into your fantasy world? So in order to be able to create the book, you have to recreate that fantasy world. And the more detail you have in that, the more immersed you get.
Yeah, very much so. So the first book I wrote, Clay, was set in a city, which was actually kind of South London, but was unspecified. And that's where I was living at the time. So that was quite easy to get that level of detail. The second was set in Shropshire. Again, I didn't say where it was, but that was it was where my in-laws lived. And so I was visiting there, and I was really longing to move out of London at that time. So I was writing about a place that I loved and I longed to be. With the third one, I managed to actually move to the place that I was longing to be. So I'm here now, which is great. So I'm probably going to write about London next.
But people have said that your books are very English and your focus is very English. And I find that kind of interesting for a nature writer, because naively, I sort of think of England as being okay, but a bit pedestrian. I mean, it's not the Amazon rainforest. It's not the deserts of Australia. You know, the multiplicity of flora, fauna around the world. And your works are quite, I'm not going to say parochial, but they're...
You can say parochial. You can absolutely say parochial. Patrick Kavanagh rescued that term. Yeah, you absolutely can. I'd be proud of that.
In that case, I will say parochial. And they're marvellous for it. They're more intense for it. Is that a fair characterization? And if so, why are you so sort of English focused?
Yes, you're right. I am in love with England and troubled by England as well. And I think that's where the interest lies. It's a difficult relationship, because what is England as opposed to Britain? You know, is it a very jingoistic, small-minded kind of nostalgic idea? What does it mean? Or is it something beautiful and old with deep roots and deep meanings? Maybe it's both those things. So my mother was born and brought up in what's now Pakistan. Her mother was Anglo-Indian, and she grew up with an idea of England that was very rose-tinted, and it was somewhere she had never been. You know, she read about in books, and she came here in partition in 47. Her and my dad, when they got married, they went back out to live in India, which is where my siblings were born. So her relationship with here was very powerful and very, she didn't take it for granted in the way that you or I might. It was beautiful and exotic, and she was always trying to find this country of Laurie Lee and Light Rise to Candleford and the Miss Reed books and The Little Grey Men and these books that she'd grown up with. And she kind of took us along on that quest to find this place, which was nowhere I knew. You know, I grew up in commuter belt Surrey near a railway junction with dad working as an accountant. I couldn't find this place, but it's kind of exists in my head, and it exists in literature, it exists in, you know, the Ladybird, what to look for in spring and what to look for in summer books that we had as children that I can still visualize every page of if I try. And so I think, you know, in my books, there's a sense of trying to find this place and trying to understand its power, because it's powerful, not just to me, but to all sorts of people. You know, it's a dream that, you know, sent men to die in trenches in the First World War. It's a dream that causes people to do terrible things, but it's also something real and beautiful with its own traditions and folklore and history. And it's that troubling seam between one thing and the other. That's kind of where I live.
Well, the folklore is a theme I wanted to bring up with you, because in All Among the Barley, there's a sort of a strong sense of folklore, witchery. I mean, if it's unclear if one of the characters has any of these powers, but even to imagine them and to self-aggrandize them for yourself, or even think that you may have them. You've spoken about how folklore is not, I think, as a lot of us imagine it, a fixed point in the past, but folklore continues to be made. What do you think the folklores are that are being made now?
There was a news story the other day about 70 coins being pulled out of the stomach of a white alligator in a zoo. Why are we throwing coins into alligator enclosures? What are we doing? You know, there's still this urge to throw coins into water. We're making offerings to river gods. These impulses are still in us. And in fact, I think they become quite resurgent at times of instability. And I think that was happening very much in the interwar years. You know, there was obviously huge kind of social upheaval, economic upheaval. There were huge wounds from the First World War that hadn't healed. And there was also the loss of one type of farming, you know, that was horse-powered and driven by a lot of superstition, was giving way to tractors and to chemical fertilizers. That sense of change led people to almost grasp onto some of those old beliefs. And I think at the moment, there's a huge resurgence of interest in ritual and folklore. There's a lot of young women particularly who are turning to kind of Wiccan beliefs and to Celtic folklore. There's a series of books by Leah Lindertz. They're almanacs, and they come out once a year, and they contain, you know, all the points in the year that you might be related to, you know, the agricultural year or to folklore, or where you can do rituals and celebrations, and including more, you know, things like points in the Muslim year and the Sikh year as well. And I think there's a revival of interest in things like Molly dancing and Morris dancing and all of those weird things where, you know, people dress up in suits made of burrs or whatever it is, or cheese rolling. And I think, you know, we're trying to hold on to this sense of continuity and the past, because everything's changing very suddenly. And we are living in a world with AI, and the seasons are shifting as well. And we're all a bit scared of that. You know, do we still have spring? Does it still exist? So these things are very deep rooted, and they don't go away. And they're very powerful. They're powerful collectively as well, because they're ways of talking about who we are.
I can entirely relate to that. And it's also sort of, there's a ritual in how people would go about going back to the daily constitution, your daily constitution, or the observation of something can often be as a result of following the same path and wanting to follow that same path. There's almost a sort of, through repetition, getting a closer affinity with yes, the place you're at, and a kind of comfort, because it brings you into the immediate and into the very close.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you about that, because I think I heard you say that you have a condition that afflicts 1-2% of the population, which is, broadly speaking, can be described as a hopeless sense of direction. Would that be roughly right?
I think a lot of people have a hopeless sense of direction. And then there's me.
Explain to us what it is.
It's called DTD, which is developmental topographical disorientation. So having any kind of internal cognitive map is something that exists on a scale, like anything else in our neurology. There are people who have an amazing sense of where they are in the world and people who have little. If you're very much at the end of that scale, then you have DTD. There are some online tests you can do. It's only been discovered in 2009, but I have known all my life that there is something very different about how I am in the world. For so long, I was, you know, trying to find a word for it, and I found that a couple of years ago. and got in touch with the researcher who named it and had a Zoom with him where we talked it through. And he said, yes, this is, you know, barring you having a brain tumor or something else, this is what's going on. I remember being maybe 12 or 13 and getting off the train at our local train station and realizing that the platform opposite was the platform that I had got on the train an hour before. And that blowing my mind. I hadn't understood that. That's just bizarre, isn't it? That's weird. That's not how people generally are. If I go to the bathroom in a restaurant or a pub, I have to think very hard on the way there about where I've gone and how many turns I've taken because I won't be able to find my way back. So I'm constantly walking into the kitchens, walking into the other part of the bar or the men's toilets, yep, darts room, leaving the building. You know, this is just, and I've stopped kind of minding about it really. That's just my norm. It makes driving difficult. So I struggle on roundabouts. I can get very disorientated. So I don't drive far. It's something that three of my sisters have as well. My mum never drove. And she couldn't tell left from right either, which is another part of it. I think, you know, as I've learned more about it, I think it is part of this need to create a place first when I'm writing. Because the other thing I do is I draw a map. I always draw a map of the village or the town or the street or whatever that I'm writing about. And I love maps because they feel very real and safe and true. It's just that I can't keep them in my mind when I'm not looking at them.
So I just wonder if that has in any way influenced the way you write and the fact that sometimes things can be hyper-local and hyper-close by. For many people who have a wanderlust and they can imagine going off to Thailand and not being, you know, they don't have this particular issue. They see a world of, they close their eyes and I'll go over here, there, and then I'll arrive over here. That's not happening for you. So I wonder if the very local, the very close, the almost immediate is in some way a sort of byproduct of this condition, or am I completely overthinking it?
No, I think that's potentially true. I mean, I do push myself. I do things. Last year, I climbed Helvellyn by myself. The year before that, I went to Austria and I climbed an Alp by myself and got down again. Didn't get lost. There was thunder and there was snow. And there was a moment when I thought, do I have to turn back now? This is a little bit scary, but I did it, you know. So I make myself do things. I've walked, when I was researching my second novel, I walked up the A5 from just outside London for 3 days. I thought I'd be able to follow the road, but of course there's private land and you can't, so I just ended up wandering around through farmland and villages. But I did that. But it's harder than it is for most people. There's a constant sense of worry and have I gone wrong and I don't know where I am. And yes, I think the world does seem perhaps bigger to me than it does to other people. I don't drive far. I couldn't just get in my car and drive to Devon. I couldn't drive to London. I've never driven to Ipswich. I live in Suffolk. So yeah, it's trains and effort and planning and courage to get about.
Right. I'm going to wrap us up now, but before I do, I'm going to take us back to where we started and I'm going to ask for a bit of help and advice. I can't bear the seasons in the way that are described. I know I'm supposed to. I have a wife who loves autumn and loves winter, but I'm a very shallow man and I love spring because things change and I love summer because it's warm and most of my work takes place at that time. And I love the light and I love everything that comes with those 6 months. And I'm not unusual in this respect. As I sit out over a very gloomy, wet Tooting right now, tell me what I can do, just give me 3 things and other people like me that can catapult us out of moderate seasonal affected disorder, which is what happens to me in winter and autumn, and allow me to appreciate the beauty of the world around me as if it's just as fabulous in January as it is in July.
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's okay to accept that there are parts of the year that you enjoy more than others. It's okay to look forward to those times of year where it's warmer and you can be outside more. Part of accepting that, and I'm going to go a bit deep here, is this is to do with death and mortality. We accept that there's parts of the year where things are decaying because they're going to feed the next year's cycle of growth. And we accept that our life has an endpoint and it's the endpoint that gives life meaning. So it's the darker, difficult parts of the year that make spring and summer beautiful and enjoyable. And if it was like that all the time, I think we might get a bit sick of it. So looking at it that way is important. And then perhaps just looking out for the small changes that lead you into the next part of the year. Things like birdsong increasing, looking for courtship behaviour in birds, looking at them shivering their wings at each other or feeding each other. Looking for your first daisy, which comes from day's eye. So they're a flower that opens when the sun rises and they close their petals at night. So look out for your first one of those. Count the firsts as they lead you through the year.
Well, there's a magnolia tree on my street that has exploded into bloom. I'm slightly scared about it because at the time of recording, it's February, and my spidey senses tell me that that's about 2 or 3 weeks earlier.
It probably is early, but can I tell you an amazing fact about magnolias?
Yes, please.
This is really good. They are such an ancient species. They evolved before bees existed. So they are not bee pollinated. They're pollinated by beetles, which are a much older kind of thing. And that's part of the reason that they bloom earlier. And they create with their petals a little microclimate that's a couple of degrees warmer than the surrounding air to attract the beetles.
Didn't know that.
It's good, isn't it?
It's brilliant. It's although I now feel moderately guilty about the fact that I was told that magnolia petals would go nicely in a salad, and I have actually been filching a couple of them, and they are utterly delicious.
Really?
They're rather peppery.
I did not know that.
Especially the pink ones.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like a kind of supercharged rocket, as in the lettuce.
Yeah. We've done a good exchange of magnolia facts there.
That's magnificent. Melissa, thank you so much for being on the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast. You've been absolutely fascinating. You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my truly fabulous guest, Melissa Harrison. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series, now available on all podcast platforms and at rathbones.com.